Good morning, Mendocino. This is Jeff Blankford, welcoming you to the October 13th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month, and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners, as I did last. Since 1993, like the most skillful of snake oil salesmen, successive Israeli prime ministers have used the so-called peace process to cover the continuing expropriation of Palestinian land and the expansion of illegal Jewish settlements in the occupied West Bank. They have been aided and abetted in this by a succession of U.S. presidents who have been either afraid or unwilling to expend the domestic political capital that would be required to challenge the considerable power of Israel's U.S. support network, euphemistically referred to as the Israel or pro-Israel lobby. This is a scenario that rarely finds its way into the American mainstream media, and more often than not only with filters in our alternative media. At the same time, in leading Israeli newspapers, Yedid Ahronot and Haaretz, one discovers a handful of courageous journalists who have consistently told the truth about their country's criminal policies and blatant hypocrisy. Their writings, however, although readily available in English on the Internet, are too hot for both U.S. mainstream media as well as America's Jewish press. Today, I'm looking forward to the pleasure of interviewing one of those journalists, Haaretz's Gideon Levy, who has just returned to Israel after a U.S. tour promoting his new book, The Punishment of Gaza, in which he exposes the myth of Israel's army as the, quote, most moral in the world, and spells out in detail the crimes his country committed against the people of Gaza over that three-week period in late December of 2008 and January 2009. We'll be talking as well about the charade known as the peace process and of the implications of a new Israeli law that will require Israeli Arabs who wish to become Israeli citizens to swear their loyalty to Israel as a, quote, democratic and Jewish state, unquote. While this new law, pushed through on Saturday by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, would not, at least for the moment, oblige those presently living in Israel to take such an oath, it would be demanded of their Palestinian spouses from the West Bank should they wish to get married and live in Israel. So that's some of what we hope to be talking about with Gideon Levy about 20 minutes past the hour. In the meantime, let's look at some other related news. In keeping with Israel's announcement about the loyalty oath, Yedid Ahronot reported that when the next ship attempts to break Israel's blockade of Gaza, the soldiers boarding the vessel will be preceded by attack dogs, quote, to prevent harm to soldiers from hostile elements on board, end quote. As an Israeli military source explained, quote, as soon as you put an attack dog in an area where soldiers are supposed to get to, it keeps the place sterile and prevents anyone from approaching, end quote. Dogs from a special Oketz unit are trained to immobilize an enemy by biting. The more the enemy struggles, the harder the bite, the paper reported. Attack dogs have proved their capabilities on many occasions, the Israeli military source said. They are strong and merciless, but in fact, this is a non-lethal weapon that can certainly do the work on the deck, end quote. Attack dogs, you will recall, proved invaluable to the police forces of racist South Africa in suppressing the resistance to apartheid, as they did four decades ago in the apartheid's U.S. South during the struggle for civil rights. Thinking positively, in the end, neither racist regime succeeded, and this latest incarnation, the State of Israel, in the end, will fare no better. As of yet, no American Jewish organizations have commented, at least publicly, on this matter, nor on the implications of Israel's new loyalty oath, but a survey released yesterday by the American Jewish Committee, the foreign policy arm of the Jewish establishment, was not particularly encouraging. According to a just-completed American Jewish Committee survey released yesterday, 49% of U.S. Jews approve, while 45% disapprove, of the Obama administration's handling of U.S.-Israel relations, whereas an earlier survey conducted in March showed that 55% approved and 37% disapproved. In contrast, the view of how Prime Minister Netanyahu is handling U.S.-Israel relations has improved. The new survey shows that 62% of American Jews approve and 27% disapprove. In March, 57% approved and 30% disapproved. What this poll implies is that by considerable difference, American Jews, at least those surveyed, are more supportive of the Israeli prime minister and his hardline policies than they are of the American president, despite his bending over backward to hold on to their support. You have probably heard by now that the Palestinian Authority has rejected an offer by Netanyahu to extend the settlement freeze that, by the way, never was, for an additional time if the Palestinians would recognize Israel as a Jewish state. Quite aside from the fact that this would amount to the legitimization of Israel's ethnic cleansing of 750,000 Palestinians and destruction of 400 of their villages in 1948 by the Palestinians themselves, this was not a serious offer on Netanyahu's part, but part of the charade worked out between the Israeli prime minister and his Palestinian puppet Mahmoud Abbas to make sure that the status quo would be maintained. Obama has said more than once that he could not want peace more than the parties themselves, and in that he was correct. As I and other critics have pointed out, the Israelis believe they are doing fine right now, have nothing to gain from further negotiations, while Abbas, whose presidential term expired in January 2009, has been closely collaborating with the Israelis in suppressing resistance to Israeli occupation in the West Bank, and should there be a just solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, he would quickly be forced into exile. In other words, what we are being exposed to is a theater of the absurd. Let's shift the focus further east to Pakistan, where the Toronto Sun's astute observer Eric Margolis writes about what he calls mission creep in Afghanistan/Pakistan. The focus of the Afghan war is clearly shifting into Pakistan, drawing that nation and the United States forces ever closer to direct confrontation, Margolis wrote last week. This grim development was as predictable as it was inevitable. Margolis' work also appears in the International Herald Tribune, has been warning for years that U.S. and NATO efforts to defeat resistance by Afghanistan's Pashtun tribes to Western occupation would eventually lead to spreading the conflict into neighboring Pakistan, a nation of 175 million people, and so it has. 2 weeks ago, Pakistan temporarily closed the main U.S.-NATO supply route from Karachi to the Afghan border at Torkham after the killing of three Pakistani soldiers by U.S. helicopter gunships, which took almost a week to elicit an apology, and that came from the NATO spokesman, not from the American spokesman. Since then, a number of U.S.-NATO fuel supply convoys, totaling at least 150 tankers, have been burned by anti-American militants. 80% of the supplies of the U.S.-led forces in Afghanistan come up this long, difficult route, notes Margolis, while along the way the U.S. pays large bribes to Pakistani officials, local warlords, and to the Taliban. Consequently, the cost of 1 gallon of gas, each gallon delivered to U.S. units in Afghanistan, has risen to $800. That's $800 a gallon. U.S. helicopter gunships have continued to stage attacks on Pakistan, in addition to the mounting number of strikes by CIA drones that are inflicting heavy casualties on civilians and tribal militants alike. U.S. Special Forces and CIA-run Afghan mercenaries are also increasingly active along Pakistan's northwest frontier. Pakistan's feeble government has long closed its eyes to CIA's drone attacks, and as Margolis points out, Washington does not even seek permission for the raids or give advance warning to Islamabad. Pakistani civilians, of course, bear the brunt of these attacks. The failing government in Islamabad is caught between two fires, writes Margolis. Pakistanis are furious and humiliated by the American attacks. Each new assault further undermines the inept U.S.-installed Zardari government, and even Interior Minister Rehman Malik, the government's supposed strongman, protested against the U.S. helicopter attacks. But Margolis continues, Pakistan is on the edge of economic collapse after its devastating floods. Islamabad is now totally reliant on $2 billion annual U.S. aid, plus tens of millions more black payments, quote-unquote black payments, from the CIA, the ones that don't appear on the books. Washington has given Islamabad $10 billion officially since 2001, most of which goes to financing the 140,000 Pakistani troops that are engaged on the Pakistani side of the U.S.-led Afghan war, but that has failed to buy Pakistani silence. An influential former Pakistani chief of staff, General Mirza Aslam Beg, has demanded that Pakistan's Air Force shoot down U.S. drones and helicopters, violating his nation's sovereignty, and his sentiments are reportedly widely shared in Pakistan's increasingly angry military. That's according to Eric Margolis. Pakistan's senior generals are being blasted as American stooges by some of the media and losing respect among Pakistanis. A video last week of the execution of six civilians by army troops has further damaged the army's reputation. However, writes Margolis, Washington's view is very different. Pakistan is increasingly branded insubordinate, ungrateful for billions in aid, and a potential enemy of U.S. regional interests. Many Americans consider Pakistan more of a foe than ally, and the limited U.S. financial response to Pakistan's disastrous flooding could be seen as a sign of that nation's poor standing in North America. U.S. aid amounted to $150 million. That was $55 million less than U.S. gave Israel to create its Iron Dome shield in northern Israel. Fears are growing in Washington that the nine-year Afghan war may be lost. American popular opinion, of course, has turned against the war. The Pentagon, notes Margolis, fears a failure in Afghanistan will humiliate the U.S. military and undermine America's international power. In short, just what happened to the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. America's foreign policy establishment is venting its anger and frustration over the failing Afghan war by lashing out at Pakistan and the U.S.-installed Karzai regime in Kabul. There is also talk in Washington of dividing Afghanistan into Pashtun, Tajik, and Uzbek mini-states, as the U.S. has almost done in Iraq, and perhaps Pakistan as well. Many Pakistanis believe the United States is bent on dismembering their nation. Some polls show Pakistanis now regard the United States as a greater enemy than India. Now that America is in full midterm election frenzy, Margolis points out, expect more calls for tougher U.S. military action in, quote-unquote, AFPAC. If polls are right and Republicans achieve a major win, it's likely, he says, there will be more and deeper U.S. air and land attacks into Pakistan. The Pentagon is convinced it can still defeat resistance by Taliban and its allies, writes Margolis, if only we can go after their sanctuaries in Pakistan, as one general told him. Where have we heard this before, asked Margolis. Why in Cambodia and Laos? That's where, during the Vietnam War. The frustrated U.S. expanded the war into Cambodia and Laos to go after communist base camps. The war spread. These two small nations were largely destroyed, but the war was ultimately lost. That's Eric Margolis writing in the Toronto Sun on October 4th. He might have added that continuing the Afghanistan war and expanding it into Pakistan is one promise that President Obama has kept. Meanwhile, in Afghanistan, the situation is no better for the administration. As you may have heard, the Senate Armed Services Committee has found that several private security contractors in Afghanistan funnel money from their Pentagon contracts into warlords and strongmen linked to murder, kidnapping, and bribery to keep them from attacking the targets that the contractors were hired to protect. The private security contractors used U.S. taxpayers' money to pay off individuals who supported the Taliban or fought against U.S. NATO forces in Afghanistan. That's according to Senator Carl Levin, the panel's chairman. One of the companies investigated, Armor Group, a subsidiary of the British company G4S, relied on Afghan warlords, some of whom were Taliban supporters, to provide manpower for the company's guard force at an Afghan airbase, the report said. During the contract period with the U.S. Air Force, one of the warlords who provided security forces for Armor Group killed another warlord in a shootout at a bazaar, according to the report. A third warlord working with the Armor Group was killed in a U.S.-Afghan military raid at his home while he was meeting with his son, who is a leader of the Taliban. In the midst of the election season, though, none of our politicians seem to care. So undeterred, the Pentagon continues with its planning for future wars, utilizing the MQ-9 Reaper, a 34.4 million a pop pilotless aircraft, a drone, that is somewhat similar to the famous Predator drone that is creating havoc in Pakistan. Until you look at its tail, or its size, or its weapons, it's called Reaper for a reason, notes Defense Industry Daily. While it packs the same surveillance gear as a Predator drone, it's much more of a hunter-killer design. Some have called it the first fielded unmanned combat air vehicle, and it is expected to play a significant role in the future U.S. Air Force operations. Just where remains to be seen. Anyone who has been seriously following the twisting paths of the Israel-Palestine conflict has heard by now of Gideon Levy, a columnist for the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. His column usually appears in the paper's weekend edition is aptly titled Twilight Zone. For more than two decades, he has been trying to get his fellow Israeli Jews to see the inherent evil in the continued occupation and settlement building in the West Bank, and before that Gaza, and to see the Palestinians as humans like themselves. This has not been a rewarding task. What apparently keeps him going is outrage against Israel's continuing violations of the Palestinians' humanity. This has culminated in a book about what the Israeli military cynically entitled Operation Cast Lead, the brutal assault visited upon the Palestinians in Gaza in the last week of December 2008 and the first 2 weeks in January 2009 that took 1,300 to 1,400 Palestinian lives. The book, a compilation of his columns written for Haaretz between 2006 and 2009, and published by Verso Books, is titled The Punishment of Gaza. Gideon Levy recently completed a U.S. tour promoting his book and is now back in Israel where I reached him. Welcome, Gideon Levy, to Takes on the World.
Thank you so much.
I'm very, very happy to have you here. The title of your sobering book is Punishment of Gaza, but in going back over earlier articles of yours that I have downloaded from the Haaretz site, that you have been writing about, it could be called the punishment of Palestine, and it could fill a volume many times as thick, and yet the situation only seems to be getting worse.
Absolutely, yes. That's the nature of occupation, that it's never in the same place. It becomes more and more brutal throughout the years. The resistance becomes more and more violent, and then the authorities use more and more violence, and it's a vicious circle which leads to anywhere.
One of the things that has always occurred to me is that every occupation, doesn't matter who is doing it, there's a certain dehumanization of the person being dispossessed or being occupied on the part of the occupier, which is necessary to allow or continue the occupation or the dispossession to continue. Is this what we see at work?
Absolutely, yes. That's a very, very important point. I truly believe that without this process of dehumanization, the occupation wouldn't have lasted for so long. Because, you know, Israelis are not monsters, and people, part of them at least, people with values. And the only way for them to live in peace with what is happening in their dark backyard is by ignoring it, on one hand, and by dehumanizing the victims. And by this, you can continue to feel very good about yourself. You maintain human rights. The only small problem is that the Palestinians are not human beings like us. And then there is no moral problem. There are no doubts. And the brainwash can continue.
Well, you note that even though the Palestinian occupation is only moments away and a short distance away from most Israelis, although most Israeli men serve in the military, there's an unwillingness to know that despite the fact you have been writing your columns and Amir Haas has been writing and just a small handful of others who have been writing for years and telling the truth, obviously they don't want to read. They don't want to find out the truth.
they don't want to read, and the entire Israeli media enables them not to read because most of the Israeli media is ignoring the occupation, does not cover it properly, and is participating and collaborating with this process of dehumanization and demonization of the Palestinians. So the Israelis can find their way both by trying to avoid any information, and there are so many agencies that enable them to do so.
Well, one of the reasons you've expressed in a recent interview in the London Independent was that you want Israelis to be unable to say we didn't know. And when I read that, I remember speaking with another Gideon Spiro back in 1983, before the Israel invasion of Lebanon, in which he and the group called, I think, in solidarity with Beit Zayt, had created a poster after 16 Palestinian civilians had been killed by the Israeli military. And it said, the letters in Hebrew, white on black, said in Hebrew, "Just don't say you didn't know." And evidently, these posters were so enraged people that they scraped off the Hebrew letters. But that was 1982, and the situation is far, far worse today, no?
Absolutely. You just mentioned 16 victims there and 1,400 in Operation Cast Lead. Everything is getting worse, both the occupation and also the cracks in the Israeli democracy, because Israel was much more sensitive 20 or 30 years ago when the society was less apathetic and less indifferent in those days. Today, if you just mentioned 82, I would like to remind you that in 82, after the massacre in Sabra and Shatila, which was not committed directly by Israelis, there were 400 Israelis in the streets. 400,000.
Yes, sure.
And now you will hardly get 400 if such a thing would have happened. So also the Israeli society went through a process of really deterioration, of really losing its values and getting into this total moral blindness.
And now, obviously, things can't stand still. They're either going to get better or they're going to get worse. And I do recall that, and I remember I met with members of Yesh Gvul, the Israeli resistance reservists, back in 83 when I was in Israel. And they had actually been talking about refusing to serve in the occupied territories at the time the Lebanese invasion took place. And, of course, then they transferred that resistance to serving in Lebanon. But now... And we used to hear maybe hundreds of soldiers or Israeli reservists refusing to serve even the occupied territories, but now we don't hear about that anymore. Is that movement dying, or people just have left Israel, chose to emigrate?
No, people didn't leave Israel, and this movement is not dying, but its echo is dying, because the media is doing anything possible to, on one hand, delegitimize them and many times even ridiculize them. We have now this new movement called Breaking the Silence, of soldiers who stand up and tell what they have been doing in Operation Cast Lead. But there is hardly an echo because they are hardly covered by the media, and the establishment did anything possible to delegitimize this movement. So there are still refuseniks, maybe less than before, but it doesn't have any public effect. That's a problem.
And there, you wrote in July of last year about the absence of an Israeli peace camp. There are many people here in this country, in the Quakers and the peace movement, the churches, who look to an Israeli peace movement as being the solution to changing the minds of Israelis. But you wrote back in July of 2010, the Israeli peace camp didn't die. It was never born in the first place. And that recalls a conversation I had with a friend of mine, General Matthew Peled, back in 83, in which he he said privately much stronger criticisms of what was supposed to be a peace movement than he said publicly, but he said, in fact, there really was not a peace movement. And that was 1983. What is the situation today? It's depressing when you read that.
It is depressing, but it's very real. We hardly have a peace camp in Israel today. There are some very devoted and courageous groups, very active ones, of young people, old people, but they are very small in numbers and very marginal in influence. One should not forget them, but they don't make any change, and they are not what we could expect, a real peace movement, a massive peace movement who might have an effect. This we lack totally, and I don't expect it for the coming future.
Well, actually, the sight of which I saw on TV of Israelis in deck chairs watching the bombardment of Gaza, and the fact that the poll showed that 94% of Israeli Jews supported the onslaught on Gaza. Was just extraordinary. It was like totally, like they removed themselves from the rest of the planet.
Yeah, 5 million Jews in Israel are sure that 7 billion people in the world are wrong, and they are right. And this scene that you were just describing now so precisely was one of the most depressing scenes I was witnessing in Operation Castle. Those families coming with their children, with their jeeps, to the hills surrounding Gaza, and showing their children with a lot of pride the bombs falling on Gaza and the white phosphor smoke coming up of Gaza. This was another sign of really the darkness that this society is in.
And you wrote about that eloquently in your book, The Punishment of Gaza, which was published by Verso, which I strongly, strongly recommend. What I find really extraordinary, I see Gaza is like a rape victim who has been raped in plain sight, and rather than assisting the victim and apprehending or controlling the rapist is given protection while he continues to do the raping.
Yes, but the people of Gaza are people with, at least most of them, or those I know, are people with dignity. Let's not forget it, people who are very courageous and really stick to their destiny in a, I would say, noble way. Let's remember what those people went through in their lifetimes, most of them refugees from 48 or sons and daughters of refugees from 48, living in poverty in refugee camps for decades now. And then one attack after the other, and the siege, which must not be ignored, and the hunger and the shortage of food or of anything that someone would need. All this they are going through, and still, in many ways, they kept their dignity.
You know, I know some people, Gaza, that I know where you're speaking. I was speaking in general of the scene from the world in which a country has been brutalized and bombed. It wasn't a war. They call in this country a turkey shoot, and yet there is no world outrage. The siege continues, and of course, as you point out. Have you pointed out several times, it'll continue to be this way until there's a change coming from the United States?
Yeah, unfortunately, I don't see any other way out, because I don't foresee any change from within the Israeli society. The Palestinians are far too weak, and the only hope can come from your country. The problem is that 2 years after President Barack Obama was elected, and we don't see any change that we were all promised and change that we were all expecting. And here we are 2 years later, and, you know, things look rather depressing. You don't see any light in the end of the tunnel, really not.
Well, you note that you had expectations for Obama in the beginning, but you seem to have given them up. And you wrote in November 9, this is a year ago, before no other country on the planet does the United States kneel and plead like this. In other trouble spots, America takes a different tone. It bombs in Afghanistan, invades Iraq, and threatens sanctions against Iran and North Korea. But Israel, the occupier, the stubborn contrarian, continues to mock America and the world by building settlements and abusing the Palestinians. And you talk about what you call the Jewish lobby. Here, you can't call it that. It's called the pro-Israel lobby. But I assume you would not, you don't look at it as doing much of a favor for Israel.
Not only this, I think it's for the long run damaging Israel, because anyone who supports Israel automatically and blindly is not a friend. Anyone who supports the Israeli occupation does not care about the future of Israel, and this is what the Israeli lobby is doing, and very unfortunate so.
Well, you wrote that the, in an interview with the Independent, you mentioned, you quoted the right-wing American Jews who became orgiastic whenever Israel kills and destroys would have to be exposed to Israel's enemies, condemning the country they supposedly love to eternal war. And you get these hate letters from American Jews, probably even more than you do from Israel.
Yes, this is true. It's always very easy or much easier to be a big patriot living outside when you don't have to pay any price for your false patriotism. And it's always the case like this, that those who sit outside are more hawkish and are pushing more for war, because they would never pay the consequences. And that's the case also with the American Jewry, who wants to have a so-called big Israel and strong Israel. They don't care about the nature of this country. They just want it to be big and strong, while they are sitting in the United States and watching it from the distance. This is unacceptable from my point of view.
My guest is Gideon Spiro from Haaretz. We're speaking with
him. Levy, let me...
Excuse me, I'm sorry. Levy, excuse me, I'm sorry. And we're speaking from Haaretz, and we're speaking with him. He's in Israel at the moment. One thing that has occurred to me some time ago, that if Israel, let's say, would make some arrangement with the Palestinians, any arrangement, in which it could no longer be perceived as being under threat. The lobby, the Jewish community that gets exercised and bloodthirsty in support for Israel would lose its clout here, and that they have a vested interest in maintaining the status quo.
Yeah, but let's also remember that also the Jewish community in the United States is going through some changes. We have now this new organization, J Street. One should not have too many expectations, but it is a new organization, and it has some achievements by now. And there is a growing number, very growing number, of members of the Jewish community in the United States who are losing any interest in Israel whatsoever. Don't forget that, as far as I know, it's only one-fifth of the Jewish community in the United States have ever bothered to visit Israel. So those things might change from within. And I'm not sure the next generation of American Jewry, or at least their leadership, will be so conservative and so blind in supporting Israel in this way.
Well, certainly, there's the activist here is a core, at most a third, and as I say, most either don't want to talk about it or don't want to get involved. Of course, J Street had a lot of promise when it came in, but it's been forced, evidently, to make compromises that have not pleased a number of its rank and file members.
Yeah, but I'm really not an expert for American
right.
Jewry. I guess you know about it much more than I do.
Well, one of the things that I find of interest was back in the 80s, the American mainstream media used to publish articles by Israeli journalist critical of Israeli policy. I don't know if they probably published some of yours, but I do remember seeing them, and now it's virtually impossible to find any article by an Israeli published in the United States that's critical of Israel, where regularly Netanyahu or Yalon, the foreign minister, deputy foreign minister, or the ambassador Michael Oren have the op-ed pages of the main newspapers open to them for their opinion pieces. And this is a sad commentary on American media.
And after all this, they complain that the American media is not even-handed and doesn't cover Israel in a friendly way enough. That's the case. But it's not the case in Europe. Europe is more open-minded, and the European media is much more critical about Israel than the American one.
What you were recently in the United States. What was your response? What was the response of your audiences when you traveled around?
I was mainly in Canada. I was only in New York City, but my tour was mainly in Canada, where I visited 7 cities in 7 days. So I could really just get impressions from the audience who bothered to come to my lectures. The outcome was very good, and I was deeply impressed by the level of knowledge, by the devotion, by the readiness, openness to hear, to learn, to be active. But I wouldn't conclude out of it about the general public opinion, neither in Canada nor in the United States, because by definition, people who come to listen to me are not, I guess, the average Canadian or the average American.
I would agree with that. Getting back to the current events, I'd like to get your thoughts on the latest kind of negotiations between supposedly between the Palestinian Authority President Abbas, who was supposed to have left office in January 2009, and Benjamin Netanyahu. And I had mentioned earlier before I called you that it really doesn't appear that Israel wants any negotiations. Obama said that he couldn't want peace any more than the parties themselves, and you've made it clear, as you've written and others have written, that Israel doesn't have any need for negotiations or want to, and Abbas has been collaborating with the Israeli government in terms of militarily with his militia. If there was any kind of settlement, he would probably be out. So what is your thoughts about this so-called peace process?
No, it's just another scene in this ongoing masquerade called peace process. And this one is a rather poor scene, because this time really nobody seriously believes in anything. I think it's all about pleasing the Americans. It's all about peace with the United States. A prime minister who is not willing even to do the most minimal step, like freezing the constructions in the settlements, is for sure not someone that can be taken seriously for making peace with the Palestinians. It's ridiculous. So we are going through these motions again, but I don't know anyone who really believes in this process, even not the right-wingers.
One of the things that's happened just quite recently, and you wrote about it on Sunday in a column called The Jewish Republic of Israel, was the introduction of a loyalty oath in which non-Jews who wish to become citizens of Israel are required to pledge their loyalty to Israel as a Jewish and democratic state. Perhaps you could comment on the implications of that. You said this is a day that Israel changes its character.
Yes, because Israel, by this, will remain neither Jewish nor democratic. Maybe Jewish, yes, but not democratic. It is just a symbolic step, and it's aimed right now only to a very small group of people who are becoming Israeli citizens and are not Jewish. But this loyalty oath is going also to be spread to other communities. And the problem is that being a Jewish state and being a democratic state is contradictory. And Israel should choose either this or this. The United States does not ask to be recognized as an American state or as a Christian state. It's enough to say it is a democracy. Same for Israel. Israel should be a democracy, period. And if the democracy decides to be Jewish, so it will be Jewish. And if the democracy decides to be secular, it will be secular. And if the democracy will decide to be binational, it will be binational. The whole thing is just to provoke, just to push the Israeli Palestinians, the Israeli Arabs, more to the corner, to alienate them even more from the country, and then to come and complain that they are not faithful citizens.
I don't know if you probably didn't hear the question. The Pope has really made a statement about condemning the Muslim Islamic world for terrorism, and he was and only the Islamic world for terrorism. And he was asking if there's any hope for peace when the Pope is so one-sided. Does this have any effect, do you believe, on the situation?
Well, as I mentioned, I don't see right now any hope. The main responsibility lies on the shoulders of Israel as the occupier. And Israel does not seem to be willing really to go for a real peace and to go for putting an end the occupation. And also about the Muslim world and the international terror connection, the world terror connection. All these things are true, but I do believe that the dispute in the Middle East is feeding so many terror organizations all over the world that the world should have been interested long time ago do anything possible to put an end to this dispute, because it's being used by so many groups and movements that only peace in the Middle East will really be a real step against terror.
Well, you've said and written a number of times that the only way there's going to be a change will not be from within, but will become when a U.S. president decides to put his foot down. But each time that happens, the lobby here reminds the president that the situation in Israel and Palestine is considered a domestic problem here, and he has to consider both not only Jewish voters, but also donations for the Democratic Party or Republican, mostly Democratic Party. Do you see any way around this, any change in this with Obama or in the future?
First of all, with all the respect, any president of the United States who surrender to this kind of pressures is not a real leader. And besides, I don't buy it that it's all about the Jewish lobby. With all the respect to its influence and power, I do believe that there are also some American interests around, and no American president is just a marionette of the Jewish lobby. This is an exaggerated description, and I truly believe that a courageous American president, a devoted one, could have brought the peace to the Middle East long time ago and without sending troops, like he has to do or thought that he has to do in Afghanistan or in Iraq.
Well, I know that the first president, George Bush, made at least an effort, at least in terms of refusing loan guarantees to Shamir when he asked for $10 billion in loan guarantees, but he ended up getting pilloried by his own party for doing that.
You to answer this, I don't think that today The Jewish lobby is the only power group in the United States, and that it is stronger than the American president. It has a lot of influence. It's being very, very aggressive, very effective. But this cannot be the whole story.
Well, no, it obviously is not the whole story. Here, we've been talking about, we're coming actually down to the end of the hour. My guest has been Gideon Levy. His new book, The Punishment of Gaza, a compilation of columns written in Haaretz from 2006 to 2009, published by Verso. You should go to your local bookstores and ask if they have this book, and if not, have them get it. It's sober reading. Gideon Levy has been writing about what has been happening to the Palestinians for more than two decades. Quickly, this is your. Just a moment. This has had an effect on your personal life, no?
It did, but I'm really not the story. The story is the Palestinians. The story is the Israeli occupation. The story is the Israeli policy. And my personal life was affected. I paid some price, but I'm for sure not a victim.
You're not a victim. Thank you.
No.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Gideon Levy, for being my guest today on Takes on the World. And I encourage you to, I know you're going to keep on writing and telling the truth. Thanks so much for being our
guest.
Thank
you so much for hosting me. Thank you very much.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.